Anybody not get a copy of the outline, would you raise your hand? We'll pass it out to you. Anyone not have a copy? Some hands are up. We can get the ushers to grab these and pass them out. Let's send our Bibles to Zechariah chapter 1. The book of Zechariah belongs in a section called the Minor Prophets. In Jewish calculations about how you number the books, the all 12 Minor Prophets form one book, one count, though we often just keep it as separate. Some Minor Prophets are very short, like Haggai, but some are much longer, like Hosea and also Zechariah. In your outline, the first six verses form the introduction to the book as a whole. Begin with verse 1, the call of the prophet. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Jehovah unto Zechariah, son of Berechiah, son of Iddo, the prophet, saying. The name Zechariah, Zechariah in Hebrew, means Jehovah remembers. Jehovah remembers. We know he came from a priestly family, from Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 4 and verse 16. Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 4 and verse 16. Many prophets do not tell us who the father is, and even less so who the grandfather is, but Zechariah provides us with both the father's name and grandfather's name. We'll see why in just a few moments. Now, the date of his call to the prophetic office is given as the eighth month. The Jewish eighth month falls between October and November of our calendar. And so, based upon the date he gives, his call came about a month before Haggai received his final message. Haggai's prophetic ministry lasted only about 3 months. And just prior to the last session of his prophetic discourse, Zechariah is called to be a prophet. In the second year of Darius, next to the year 520 BC, so the call of the prophetic office for Zechariah came somewhere in October, November, in the year 520 BC. And the prophetic period was much longer than that of Haggai. He operates from about 520 to 470. From 520 to about 470, his prophetic ministry lasted roughly about 50 years. And the locale of his ministry is in the city of Jerusalem. Now, the historical background to his prophetic call can be seen in the context of the captivity and the return from the captivity. He is mentioned by name in Ezra chapter 5, verse 1. Ezra chapter 5, verse 1, again in chapter 6, verse 14. It was a time in Jewish history when most of the Jews chose to remain in Babylonia, but a minority of Jews chose to come back to the land in keeping with God's call. It was a point of time when finally idolatry was forsaken. Now, the reason God brought on the Babylonian captivity was for two main sins. First of all, they failed to keep the sabbatical year, and therefore, because they failed to keep it 70 times, that was the reason for the 7 years of captivity. But the primary reason for the captivity was the practice of idolatry. And what is interesting is that God sent them to Babylonia, which was the center of worldwide idolatry. And when they came to Babylon, they got so much of idolatry, they finally got sick of it. And rarely did idolatry become a problem in the Jewish community when they came back from Babylon. There were small outbreaks of it during the Maccabean period, the Hasmonean period, but largely it had been forsaken by the Jewish people. Furthermore, in Babylonia, they had invented the concept of the synagogue to come together to study the scriptures. And now they brought the synagogue concept back into the land of Israel. You don't find synagogues before the time of the return from Babylonia. or many of these came back to receive the call to return to land, the spiritual conditions were at the Purim, as comes out in both Haggai and Zechariah. And therefore God sent three prophets to the post-captivity Jewish population. Two of these were contemporaries, Haggai and Zechariah. And then after the time of Haggai and Zechariah, then came Malachi. Well, Haggai and Zechariah primarily prophesied in the days of Zerubbabel, a person we'll get back to a bit later. Malachi became a prophet at the time of Nehemiah. Among the major points we'll find in this book is that the main purpose of this book is to trace God's program for Israel during the times of the Gentiles. Now keep in mind the prophet Daniel came before Zechariah, and Zechariah will often build on what Daniel had already been revealed and what Daniel had found in his own book. But Daniel's basic theme is the times of the Gentiles, and he focuses on the four Gentile empires from Babylon until the final ruler, the Antichrist, that will be in rule at the time of the second coming. And now Zechariah comes along, and his specific theme is Israel during the times of the Gentiles. Israel during the times of the Gentiles. And the key phrase he uses, the term Jehovah of hosts, the Lord of hosts, or the Jehovah of hosts. In this 14 chapter book, he will use that term 52 times. 52 times are called Jehovah of hosts. The host refers to normally the angelic armies. He's the one in charge of all the angelic armies that God will use to carry out his program. The basic outline of the book is very simple because the way he put things together, he begins in chapters 1 through 6 with the eight visions. And then a second division is chapters 7 through 8, the four messages concerning fasting. And then the third part are the two burdens, comprising chapters 9 through 14. The first burden comprises chapters 9 through 11. The second burden is chapters 12 through 14. Now, my goal for today is to cover to the end of chapter 8 and then do chapters 9 through 14 tomorrow, and we'll see how we handle this material, how time goes. Now, four segments of the prophet Zechariah are quoted by the New Testament. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, Zechariah 9:9, the prophecy about Messiah riding upon a donkey into Jerusalem. This is quoted in Matthew chapter 21, verse 4 and 5, Then Zechariah chapter 11, verse 13, the prophecy about the 30 pieces of silver will be quoted in Matthew chapter 27, verse 9, Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, which talks about the Messiah being pierced, is quoted in John chapter 19, verse 37, And one more passage, Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7, the prophecy about dispersion because of Israel's rejection, is quoted twice in Matthew chapter 26, verse 31, and Mark chapter 14, verse 27, Look again at verse 1. Came the word Jehovah, and he mentions three generations to Zechariah the prophet. And again, Zechariah means Jehovah remembers. His father's name is Berechiah, which means Jehovah blesses. And his grandfather's name is Iddo, meaning his time. So you put the meaning of the three names together, and the Hebrew reader would catch this. What he's saying is Jehovah remembers and Jehovah blesses in his time. The three names together would mean just that. Jehovah remembers and Jehovah blesses in his time. Then in verse 2, he points out the declaration of past history. Jehovah saw displeased with your fathers, and that has been brought out in the previous prophets before the exile. And the fathers are the ones who sinned, the sins that brought on the Babylonian captivity. So God was displeased with them, which is why he brought them into 7 years of captivity. But now in verses 3 and 4, there is a call to repentance. Therefore, say unto them, thus says Jehovah, and in verse 3 offers a reciprocal arrangement. Return to me, says Jehovah of hosts, I will return to you, says Jehovah of hosts. And this is the way it will be true throughout the times of the Gentiles, from Babylon to the second coming. When Jews return to the Lord, he'll return to them. Sadly, only a minority of Jewish people would come to faith over the years, but there always is a remnant of Israel, large or small. But that's the reciprocal arrangement throughout the times of the Gentiles. Furthermore, in verse 4, he wants them not to become like the fathers who rejected the prophets. Be not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets cried. The former prophets are the pre-exilic prophets, like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and others. And those pre-exilic prophets called upon the Jewish people to repent of their sins, return to the Lord to avoid the captivity, to avoid the destruction of the city and the temple. And the prophets call for repentance, saying two things. Number one, return from evil ways, and from evil, secondly, from evil doings. And the evil ways and evil doings, in what they thought and what they did, were in contradiction to what the law said and the law of Moses and what the prophets said in the prophets. Just to give you one example from the three major prophets, Isaiah chapter 55, verse 6 and 7, Isaiah 55, verse 6 and 7, Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 12 and 13, Jeremiah 3, verse 12 and 13, Ezekiel chapter 18, verses 30 and 31, Ezekiel 18, 30 and 31. This is a small example. There are many more examples within these prophets and other prophets. Call the nation repentance, telling them you can avoid the final destruction by Babylon by a simple act of return to the Lord. The same message Hosea gave to Northern Kingdom in Hosea chapter 14, verse 1 and 2, Hosea 14, verses 1 and 2. But as verse 4 points out, the prophets were rejected. They did not hear nor hearken unto me, says Jehovah, and they failed to respond to the call of the prophets. And this leads in verses 5 and 6 to a small dialogue of conflict between Israel and the prophet. God speaks and says in verse 5, your fathers, where are they? And the answer is, they're all dead. And they died in captivity. And why they died in captivity and not in their home? Because of disobeying the prophets. And the people respond and say, but the prophets did not make it either. The prophets also died. And that's true enough. The prophets also died. The difference is, the prophets did not die because of a divine discipline. But the people, their fathers, did die because of divine discipline. So here's the prophets that died, but God responds in verse 6, but my words, which the prophets spoke, were fulfilled. But my words, which my statutes, which I commend my servants the prophets, did they not overtake your fathers? And the question demands a positive answer. Yes, it did indeed come to pass. And furthermore, in the captivity, these fathers also finally confessed the word of God had been fulfilled in their lives. And they turned and said, like as Jehovah hosts taught to do to us, according to our ways, according to our doings, so he's dealt with us. So the fathers whose sins brought on the captivity, when once they went into captivity, at least finally admitted that what God said would happen finally has happened. And they admitted that the words the prophet spoke were true and now suffering the consequences of disobeying the law and the prophets. And that's Zechariah's introduction to his book, and telling us about the basics of what he was called to do. This brings us to the first main division of the book, the eight visions from chapter 1, verse 7 to chapter 6, verse 8. Eight visions. These are visions that carry a specific prophetic message, both from the present day of their day right on to the establishment of the kingdom. Now the first vision is in chapter 1, verses 7 through 17. Chapter 1, verse 7 through 17. And the point of the first vision is God has a plan for Israel. God does have a plan for Israel. Before we deal with the details, let me summarize what this vision will say in 3 points. Number one, the angel of Jehovah is in the midst of a degraded and deprived people. The angel of the Lord is standing in the midst of a degraded and deprived people. Secondly, he makes a loving and yearning intercession for them, intercedes for them to God the Father. And then thirdly, there's the promise of future blessing. The promise of future blessing. Now, point one, the vision of the horses in chapter 1, verses 7 through 11. He again provides us with a specific date, even more specific than previously, on the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month of Shvat, in the second year of Darius. Now, converting this to our calendar, this vision came to him on February 15th, 519 BC. February 15th, 519 BC. This was 3 months after his call in verses 1 through 6, so between verse 6 and verse 7, 3 months pass. In the second year of Darius, which makes it 519 BC, once again the word comes to the prophet. What he sees in verses 8 through 11 is a vision of the horses. In verse 8, the horses, the vision, I saw in the night, behold, a man riding upon a red horse. He stood among the myrtle trees that were at the bottom. The word bottom means a low, shady place. And so in this vision, what the horses are found, they locate in the bottom of a low and shady place. This will symbolize as the Gentile world. And the term myrtle trees is significant because myrtle trees were among the trees used for the Feast of Tabernacles. And towards the end of the book in chapter 14, verses 16 through 21, chapter 14, 16, 21, he will make a reference to the Gentiles, the observance of the Feast of Tabernacles. So beginning the low shady place, the myrtle trees, it puts it into a Gentile setting. And behind there were horses of three different colors, red, sari, or ruddy color, and then white. Now these are not little horses as we think of horses, as the context was shown. These are divine agencies in the affairs of government. These are God's divine agencies that function in dealing with governments, especially governments that come in contact with the Jewish people and Jewish population. Now they're more than just horses, we can see in verse 9, because Zechariah requests for an identification. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel talked to me, said, I will show you what these are. This is the rider of the red horse, he's the angel of Jehovah. Now it's been a while since this person appeared in the biblical record, because he's mostly appearing in the 5 books of Moses and the early records of Joshua and Judges, rarely after that. But this is not a common, ordinary angel, because in every context where he appears, some in the context is called Elohim or God, or called Yahweh, Adonai, or Jehovah. And this is one of the ways that the second person of the triune God appeared in human history, in the person of the angel of Jehovah. So he's more than just a common angel. He is indeed the second person of the triune God. And in verse 10, we have the identification. The man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom Jehovah has sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And again, this shows them to be more than little horses. These are angelic beings that have very specific missions. And the phrase to and fro is often the phrase used of angelic movement. You see this in Job chapter 1, verse 7. Job chapter 1, verse 7, and Job chapter 2, verse 2. Job chapter 2, verse 2. So these angelic beings that God uses to carry out his purposes, especially purposes in the realm of Gentile governments. And what they're gathering to do in verse 11 is to report the angel of Jehovah. And he answered the angel of Jehovah that stood among the mill trees, "We have walked to and fro to the earth," meaning the mission has been accomplished. They did walk throughout the earth. And the report is this: all the earth sits still and is at rest. The earth is still and is at rest. In other words, nothing is moving to accomplish God's purposes with Israel, spelled out by the previous prophets. Nothing is moving towards the accomplishment of God's plan. The whole world is simply still. Israel is desolate. Israel is being deprived. The promises are not being fulfilled to Israel, and nothing in the world is moving towards the fulfillment of these prophecies. And while the world being still and at peace seems to be good news for the world, it's actually bad news for Israel. As long as the earth is still in rest and nothing is moving, God's promises remain unfulfilled. Now, on the point two, you have the promise of mercy to Zion in chapter 1, verses 12 to 17. In verse 12, we have the prayer of the angel of Jehovah. "O Jehovah hosts, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem and the cities of Judah against which you have had indignation these 70 years?" In other words, when will God begin to move to restore Jerusalem that has lied desolate for 70 years? The world is indeed at peace, but Israel is still in degradation. And this shows another key ministry of the angel of Jehovah. He prays for the Jewish people. He intercedes for the Jewish people. In the same way, he intercedes for us, now at the right hand of God the Father. Besides being the high priest at the right hand of God the Father, the Messiah is also an advocate or a lawyer, interceding on behalf of the saints. So Satan can stand in heaven, as he will see him doing later on in the book of Zechariah, to accuse the saints. The Messiah can say, "I laid that sin upon my account. I have already paid for that sin when I died for the person on the cross." Here's a basic truth you may not be aware of. If you're a believer, you have a Jewish lawyer sitting at the right hand of God the Father. He's never lost a case yet, which is why your salvation is eternally secure. And this is similar to what the angels do in Isaiah chapter 62, verse 6 and 7. Isaiah 62, 6 and 7. God's placed angels upon the walls of Jerusalem, and only purpose for being there is to keep reminding God of the promise he made to restore Jerusalem and to make Jerusalem a praise in the earth, to make Jerusalem the capital of Messiah's kingdom. And so the angels, other angels, are praying on the walls of Jerusalem to this day. This is what the angel Jehovah prayed in this context specifically. In verse 13, there's a message of comfort to the angel of Jehovah. "Jehovah answered the angel to talk with me, and the content was good words and comfortable words." So God the Father answers the angelic son with good words and comfortable words. And therefore he tells Zechariah to cry out seven declarations now to be found in verses 14 to 17. Seven declarations which the angel Jehovah had received from Jehovah the Father. Number one, in verse 14, "I am jealous for Jerusalem with a great jealousy." We tend to use jealousy in a more negative sense, but in Scripture it's used either positively or negatively. By itself, it's a neutral term. It could be used negatively or positively. The basic meaning is the right of possession, exercising the right of possession. And Jerusalem and Zion is God's possession. Therefore, those who violate the city, and those who violate the nation, those who violate the land, raises God's jealousy that burns with fire. Second declaration in verse 15, "I am very sore displeased with the Gentiles that are at ease." Hebrew literally reads, "With great anger I am angered. With great anger I am angered." Now, the sin of the Gentile nations is the sin of anti-Semitism. But did not God use these Gentile nations to punish his people? The answer is yes, but notice what else Zechariah tells us. He quotes God as saying, "I was but a little displeased." He was but a bit displeased against Israel. but they have followed the affliction. At the worst, they went beyond what God had intended. God had indeed intended to use them to punish Israel, but it was went beyond the point where God intended them to go. And therefore allowed their anti-Semitism to cross the line. And this point in verse 15 will receive elaboration by the second vision at the end of the chapter. Third declaration in verse 16, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies, and God is intending to return to Jerusalem and show his mercy upon the city. And fourthly, in verse 16, my house shall be built in it. My house shall be built in it. Indeed, the temple will be rebuilt. And we shall see this elaborated by the fifth vision later in Zechariah. Fifth statement, a line shall be stretched out over Jerusalem, and the line being stretched out over Jerusalem is a symbol of building. The city will be built, it will be elaborated, it will be extended, and this will receive elaboration by the third vision. The third vision. Number 6 in verse 17, my city shall yet overflow with prosperity, and although they now suffer deprivation, the promise is someday they'll be a very prosperous city. And suddenly, in the end of verse 17, Jehovah shall yet comfort Zion and shall yet choose Jerusalem, which will receive elaboration by the fourth vision. Now, this is the city God has chosen to be his city. This is the city he has chosen to erect his previous Davidic king and his future Davidic king. And therefore, he will comfort Zion and promises a final full restoration. Now, capital B, we come to the second vision in chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. The main point of the second vision is this. God is in control of human affairs. God is in control of human affairs. Let me summarize the vision before we do the details. Elaborate the point he made back in verse 15, that God will punish the Gentiles. So God takes into account everyone who lifts his hand up against the Jewish people. God takes into account everyone who lifts his hand up against the Jewish people. He has a complete knowledge of the condition of his people. He has already pronounced judgment upon those people who rose against the Jewish people. He's already pronounced a judgment against those for rising against the Jewish people. And what we have here is a key principle of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. Genesis 12:3, I will bless them that bless you, but him that curses you will I curse. And the focus here will be on cursing them who curse the Jewish people. Now point one, the four horns in verses 18 and 19. This is the vision of the four horns, lifted up mine eyes and saw a new vision now. And the content of the vision is, behold, four horns. And in verse 19 again asks the question, what are these? And the answer is, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And again, it's building what Daniel had already been revealing to us, that these four horns represent the four Gentile empires responsible for scattering the Jewish people throughout the world. And these are the four of Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. The first empire was the Babylonian Empire. Secondly came the Medo-Persian Empire. Thirdly, the Hellenistic Empire. Then fourthly, the Empire of Imperialism that began with Rome and continues to this day. The word horn symbolizes power and pride. Power and pride. And notice the three categories, Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Judah was the southern kingdom. Israel, the northern kingdom. Jerusalem is always treated as a separate entity, a separate category because of the uniqueness of its position before the Lord. Then point 20, outline verse 20 and 21, he sees the four smiths. In verse 20, the four smiths come into the vision, and in verse 21, again, the question, then said I, what come these to do? And the answer is, these are the horns which scattered Judah, so that no man lifted up his head. In other words, they failed to respond in mercy. But these are come to terrify them. These are come to punish the horns and to cast down the horns of the nations. And these are the four different men responsible for casting down the four Gentile empires. The first smith then would be Cyrus the Great. The second horn, the second smith would be Alexander the Great. Cyrus brought down Babylonia. Alexander brought down the Medo-Persian Empire. The third smith would be Pompey. Pompey was the Roman general that finally ended Herod the rule of Israel and brought Israel into the Roman Empire. And the fourth smith would be the Messiah himself to bring to an end the fourth empire's rule over the Jewish people. And the last ruler of the fourth empire would be the Antichrist, that will suffer his demise at the second coming of the Messiah. And the reason, he says, they lifted up their horn against the land of Judah to scatter it. Here again we see the outworking of the Abrahamic covenant of Genesis 12:3. I will curse them, they curse you. So every empire that is responsible for captivating, scattering the Jewish people are receiving divine discipline, divine judgment from the Lord. And therefore each empire that mistreats the Jews ends up ultimately falling. And the final fall will come by the Messiah himself. Now, capital C, the third vision, we come to chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, with the point being Jerusalem will be the capital of the millennial earth. Jerusalem will become the capital of the Messianic kingdom. And this will elaborate what he said back in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. Now the vision is found in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, the vision of the man and the measuring line. And in verse 1 we see a surveyor with the measuring line. I lifted up mine eyes and saw a new vision. And the content is, behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. And again, the measuring line is a symbol of building up. Other examples of this symbol is Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 38 through 14. Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 3. Revelation chapter 21, verse 15. And the point is, Jerusalem is destined to become a built-up city. In verse 2, we see the purpose. In verse 2, the question is, said I, where are you going? And the answer is to measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth of it and the length of it. In other words, to measure Jerusalem in view of its complete and total restoration. And the message comes in verses 3, 4, and 5. The angel's command is, behold, the angel talked to me, went forward. Another angel went out to meet him and said to him, run. Showing a sense of urgency, run. Speak to this young man, meaning to Zechariah. And another angel is now told, run and tell this young man the good news. The good news in the verse 4 is, Jerusalem will be inhabited as villages without walls by reason of the multitude of men and cattle therein. In other words, Jerusalem will be too great, too large, too many to put in the confines of a wall. And the city without wall is a symbol of security, as we see in Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 11. In verse 5, Jehovah will be the wall and the glory. In other words, God will be a wall of fire around the city, and that will show the manner of its protection, and those who try to touch it for the purpose of harming it will simply find their hands being burned. It says, God will be the glory in the midst of her, and this is the presence of the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory. One definition of Shekinah glory is the visible manifestation of the presence of God, the visible manifestation of God's presence. So whenever the invisible God became visible, and whenever his omnipresence was localized, the physical localized presence would be the Shekhinah. And because the Messiah, the God-man, would be within the city, ruling in the Messianic kingdom, and have the very presence of the Shekinah glory in the person of the Messiah, the God-man. Now, following the vision, we have under point 2, the explanation in verses 6 to 13. It begins with a call to leave Babylon in verse 6 and 7. Now, depending on what translation you happen to be using, some people view verse 6 as the biblical background to Santa Claus. It says in some translations like mine, "Ho, ho, flee from the land of the north." And who comes from the north saying, "Ho, ho"? So some people think this is Santa Claus, but that's a bit of a stretch. Now, the vision ends in verse 5, and now we have an explanation in verses in the following verses. And what they're supposed to flee from is the land of Babylon. And again comes the call for the Jews still in Babylonia to leave Babylonia. They do not respond to the call. The majority of the Jewish population in Babylon stayed put because life got good for them in Babylonia. But the call is for them to come back. For I spread you abroad in the four winds of the heavens. Escape you that dwell among the daughters of Babylon. So in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, in the future, Israel will undergo a final restoration with the city becoming the capital of the world. They must respond to this call even now to begin entering into the God's blessing now, and the blessing will come if they return to the land. The blessing will not come if they stay in Babylonia. And again, they did not come back from Babylonia, and as a result, in the course of time, the blessing was gone. It was in Babylonia that developed the larger Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, has become the fundamental scriptures of Orthodox Judaism to this day. And so the biblical Judaism got further and further away from the scriptures, further and further perverted by means of the Babylonian Talmud, put together by the Jews who chose to stay in Babylonia. In verse 8 and 9, he focuses on the coming of the Messiah. Notice who the speaker is in verse 8. For thus says Jehovah of hosts. Notice the speaker is Jehovah himself. And what he says is, after glory has he sent me unto nations which plundered you. Because of God's glory, he sends the Messiah. And he gave Abraham a covenant. He sent to punish those nations for the mistreatment of the Jews in keeping Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. Genesis 12, 3. And the reason is given in the verse. He who touches Israel touches the apple of his eye. The apple is the pupil of the eye. Literally in Hebrew, the gate of the eye. Now, when somebody puts this finger on the pupil of your eye, the first response is to hit it, to get it out of the way, because it's tormenting the eye. That's the picture. When somebody touches Israel, he's touching the apple of God's eye, and God's response is to hit it away. And that happens over and over and over again. The judgment is, I will shake my hand over them. They shall be a spoil to those that serve them. And so Israel's become a spoil to many nations, but now the nations will become a spoil for Israel. And notice he says, you shall know Jehovah of hosts hath sent me. Those two persons called Jehovah in these two verses. Notice in verse 8, it is Jehovah doing the speaking. At the end of verse 9, he says, you shall know Jehovah of hosts hath sent me. Both the speaker and the one spoken to is called Jehovah of hosts. One of those rare passages in the Old Testament, you see at least two persons of the Godhead. Jehovah is the speaker, and Jehovah is also the one who was sent. And this is the indications of plurality in the Godhead within the Old Testament scriptures. In verses 10 through 13, he promises God will someday inhabit Jerusalem. And in verse 10, 11, Jehovah will indeed indwell Jerusalem itself. So in verse 10, Israel is called upon to rejoice, for God will dwell in her. Sing, rejoice, daughter of Zion. The reason of lo, I come, the second coming. I will dwell in the midst of you, Jerusalem, and the God-man Messiah will set up his throne within the city of Jerusalem. And furthermore, many Gentiles will come, in verse 11, when nations shall join themselves to Jehovah in that day, many Gentiles will be saved during the time of the tribulation. Now they will come to worship God, and they shall be my people. Not only are the Jewish believers going to be God's people, but the Gentile believers also God's people. And these are the sheep Gentiles of Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46. The sheep Gentiles of Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46. In verse 11, Messiah's dwelling in Israel's midst will be the evidence that God did send him. Verse 11, I will dwell in the midst of you. Literally in Hebrew, I will Shekinah with you. That will be the visible manifestation of God's presence. You shall know Jehovah host has sent me unto you. Once again, to Jehovah's, the speaker and the sender about Jehovah's. And in verse 12, Jehovah will inherit Judah. Jehovah shall inherit Judah and as his portion in the Holy Land. And notice this is the only place in Scripture land is called the Holy Land. We use the term frequently, but in Scripture it's found only in this one location. Israel is God's inheritance, and because Israel, the land is God's inheritance, is called the Holy Land. And because he has chosen the land, he also someday chose Jerusalem to be his capital. So in verse 13 is a call to hold the earth to remain silent. Be silent, all flesh, before Jehovah. Reason, for he's waked out of his holy habitation. Here God is pictured in the figure of a lion about to come out of his place to fulfill the promise. That's the point of the vision. God is now in the figure of a lion about to come out of his lair for the purpose of fulfilling the promises he had made. Now we come to the fourth vision in chapter 3, verses 1 through 10. The point of the fourth vision is this: God will cleanse Israel so the nation can fulfill the function of a kingdom of priests. God will cleanse Israel so Israel can fulfill the function of a nation of a kingdom of priests. That was the calling back in the book of Exodus. Chapter 19, verse 5 and 6. Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. But sadly, they have failed to fulfill that function. On one hand, Israel had a priestly tribe to represent Israel to God, but as a nation, Israel was to be a priestly nation, representing Gentiles to God. And this they failed to do. But in the future, they'll fulfill that function. We can summarize this vision in two points. First of all, before the blessings of the previous vision could be fulfilled, there must be a spiritual transformation. Before the blessings of the previous visions can be fulfilled, there must be a spiritual transformation of the people of Israel. And secondly, the purpose is to restore the people's confidence in the priesthood. Because Ezekiel points out in the first 11 chapters of his book, chapters 1 through 11 of Ezekiel, it was the priesthood that led the people into idolatry. It was the priesthood that turned the Jewish temple built for the glory of the one true God into a major center of idolatry. And so the priesthood has become negative, but the purpose of this vision is to restore their confidence in the priesthood. And those who led them into sin and brought them into captivity must not be the ones to lead them back to a relationship with the Lord. Now, point one, the court case in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. In this vision, he sees a court case. The verse 1 provides the situation, and he showed me a new vision. What he sees is Joshua. Joshua was the high priest of that day. And as the high priest represents Israel, he is the defendant in the trial. He's the high priest. We note this from Ezra chapter 4, verse 3, chapter 4, verse 3, chapter 5, verse 2, chapter 5, verse 2. Also Haggai chapter 1, verse 1, Haggai chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 12. Verse 1 and verse 12, and chapter 2, verse 2. Chapter 2, verse 2. And we'll see it again at the end, later on in Zechariah chapter 6, verses 11 through 15. Zechariah 6, 11 through 15. And in this vision, he sees sees Joshua standing before in the court of law. So if Joshua is condemned, so will Israel be condemned. If Joshua is cleansed, so Israel will be cleansed. And the judge is the angel of Jehovah again. But the prosecuting attorney happens to be Satan. Standing at his right hand for the purpose to be his adversary. Now we know from Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, Revelation is that he is the accuser of the saints. So whenever a believer nowadays falls in a state of unconfessed sin, eventually Satan will appear before the Father to accuse that believer of the sin he's involved in. But not only do we find out in this passage he is the accuser of the saints, he's also Israel's accuser. And he appears in heaven periodically to accuse the Jewish people of their sins. And in fact, that's the reason in Judaism they have the Feast of Trumpets. Because what the rabbis have added to what Zechariah chapter 3 teaches is this, that when Satan goes up into heaven to accuse Israel, only does it one day in the whole year, the day of the Feast of Trumpets. It's a long list to bring before the Lord about the sins of Israel. But as he's about to begin reading the sins of Israel, suddenly in the synagogues around the world, for 24 hours around the world, they blow the shofar, they blow the ram's horn. And all this noise of the shofar confuses the mind of Satan, and he fails to even bring out one single accusation. This happens year after year after year, according to rabbinic tradition. I would think after so many years, he would learn to count God to heaven some other date in the Feast of Trumpets, but apparently he doesn't quite learn that lesson. And the term shofar is the name of the ram's horn. And the name came from the events of Joshua at Jericho. He was told to march around Jericho around seven times, then to blow the shofar, and suddenly all the walls of Jericho fell down. He was heard to say, shofar, show good. That's how the name came into being. But in verse 2, we have the rebuking of Satan. And God says to Satan, it's a very strong rebuke, Jehovah rebuke you, Satan. Yea, Jehovah that has charged Jerusalem rebuke you. And the Hebrew word for rebuke is a strong word. It means to suppress and annihilate the accusation. To suppress and to annihilate the accusation. And the grounds of this rebuke is God will yet choose Jerusalem. God will yet choose Jerusalem. He does not rebuke Satan because the accusations are not true. They are true. He does not rebuke Satan because Israel was righteous. Israel was not righteous. He rebukes Satan because God has chosen this people, He's chosen this land, He's chosen to this city to be His. And therefore he has an unchanging love for the Jewish people regardless of the status of sinfulness. And therefore God will yet save Israel. And yes, the question, is this not a brand plucked out of the fire? A wood that's burning the fire is suddenly taken out of the fire. Wood that's burning but is safe from being destroyed by the fire because God still has a purpose for it, still has a use for it. A point also made in Amos chapter 4, verse 11. Amos 4:11. But the fact that Satan's accusations are actually true comes out in verse 3, describing the state of Joshua. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments, describing Israel's present state. The term filthy garments doesn't show the negative in English that the Hebrew shows, but it's filth of the most loathsome, uncleanest kind. The filth of the most loathsome and unclean type. Mentioned in the same word in Isaiah chapter 4, verse 3 and 4, Isaiah 4, verse 3 and 4, Isaiah chapter 64, verse 6, Isaiah 64, 6. And this element on the high priest renders the high priest unclean ceremonially. He's ceremonially unclean. And he's standing before the angel in the court of law. But in verse 4, he has a change of garments. And the judge orders, he speaks to the angels, and the commanders, take the filthy garments from off him. That marks the forgiveness of his sin. As in Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10, 61:10 Isaiah, the changing of garments, a symbol of salvation. And the judge issues his verdict. Behold, I have caused your iniquity to pass from you. The sins are forgiven. I will clothe you in rich apparel, which will be the garments of salvation. In verse 5, we have the placing of the mitre. I let them set a clean mitre upon his head. The mitre is the priestly head, hat. On the head was a gold plate, saying in Hebrew, holiness unto Jehovah. Holiness unto Jehovah. So they set a clean mitre on his head, give him clean garments, probably priestly garments. And so the angel Jehovah was standing by, showing his approval of what the angels are doing. And now point two, we have in verses 6 to 10, the message of the angel, the message to Joshua. And in verse 6, the message to Joshua very strongly stated, the angel Jehovah protested unto Joshua. It's very emphatically stated. And in verse 7, his duties are two things. Walk in my ways, keep my charge. Walk in my ways. This is personal work before the Lord, his own spirituality, his own relationship to the Lord. And keep my charge. These are his official duties, the temple compound, to determine what is kosher, what is not, to determine what can be sacrificed, what cannot be sacrificed. And if he fulfills these duties faithfully, at the end of verse 7 comes his reward. You will judge my house. My house is the temple. He will function over temple duties. Again, to determine what is kosher, what is not, what is sacrificial, what is not. You will keep my courts. He will control who goes in, who does not go in. And I will give you a place of access among these that stand by. He'll have access to the angelic court, mentioned earlier in verse 4. So Joshua will be the high priest representing the people to God, and therefore his intercessions, his prayers went into the angelic court in heaven itself. In verse 8, he mentions the priests are a sign. Notice the addressee, hear now, O Joshua, thy priest, you and your fellows that sit before you. And these are the other priests that also function under Joshua. They are a sign. A sign of what? A sign that God will bring forth his servant, the branch. And among the messianic names in the scriptures for the Messiah is the branch. And there are four facets of the branch doctrine, two of which will come out in Zechariah. Now, two are outside of Zechariah. But here in verse 8, notice the servant is, the branch is a servant. That happens to be the theme of the Gospel of Mark. And Mark's theme is Jesus the Messiah, the servant of Jehovah. Later in Zechariah chapter 6, verse 12, the servant is a man, he's human. And that'll be the theme of the Gospel of Luke. Luke's theme is Jesus the Messiah, the Son of Man. Outside of Zechariah, the third facet of the branch doctrine is that the branch is a king. The branch is a king. This comes out in Isaiah 11, verse 1. Isaiah 11, verse 1, Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 5, 23, 5, and chapter 33, verses 15 and 16, 33, verses 15 and 16. And that's the theme of the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew's theme is Jesus the Messiah, the King of the Jews. And the fourth facet of the branch doctrine is that the branch is also God himself. The branch is God himself. This comes out in Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2. Isaiah 4, verse 2, Jeremiah 23, verse 5 and 6. Jeremiah 23, verse 5 and 6. And Jeremiah 33, verse 15 and 16. Jeremiah 33, verse 15 and 16, that's the theme of John's Gospel. And John's theme is Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God, emphasizing his deity. Not only is the term branch used as a messianic name for the Messiah, so is the term stone in verse 9. For behold, the stone which I have set before Joshua, upon one stone of seven eyes. Now Daniel already presented the Messiah as a stone in Daniel chapter 2, verse 35. Daniel chapter 2, verse 35. Other examples of the stone used for the Messiah are Isaiah 28, verse 16, Isaiah 28, verse 16, Psalm 118, verse 22, Psalm 118, verse 22. Upon one stone are seven eyes. One stone, there is only one Messiah. Seven eyes shows he is all-seeing. And the priesthood is a type of the all-seeing Messiah. The rulers rule in the Messianic kingdom. He says, I'll engrave the graving thereof, the invocation of the name of the stone. But notice what the promise at the end of verse 9 is. I'll remove the iniquity of that land in one day. What land? That land, the holy land of chapter 2, verse 12. Notice in this passage, chapter 3, verse 9, he'll take away the iniquity all in one day. Because Israel's national regeneration will occur in just one day, a point also made in Isaiah chapter 66, verse 8. Isaiah 66, 8, the people will be born in one day. Another passage to note is Micah chapter 5, verse 15 to chapter 6, verse 3, Hosea chapter 5, verse 15 to chapter 6, verse 3. Hosea chapter 5, verse 15 to chapter 6, verse 3. Then the last 3 days before the second coming, there'll be a national salvation. For the first 2 days, they'll confess the sin of rejecting the Messiah. And the third day, they will all come to faith. The whole nation will be born again in just one day, and therefore the sins removed of the land all in one day. And Israel's salvation is the prerequisite to the second coming and the prerequisite to the Messianic kingdom. So when the sins were moved in verse 9 and verse 10, we are told, there'll be a summary of the millennium. In that day, said Jehovah, shall you invite every man to his neighbor and his vine and his fig tree. And these are symbols of security and prosperity in the Messianic kingdom. Symbols of security and prosperity in the Messianic kingdom. You see this elsewhere in Isaiah chapter 36, verse 16. Isaiah 36, verse 16, and Micah chapter 4, verse 4. Micah chapter 4, verse 4. So again, this will come as saved as a nation, all in one day, the iniquity removed in one day. As though the Messiah return, only then shall we see the final restoration of all the Jewish people in all of the promised land, finally living in peace and not in turmoil as we have it today. All right, we'll take our break at this point, and then we'll continue after the break.